Next case before us today is 20-2176 Hernandez versus Lujan Gresham. Counsel for appellant, if you'd make your appearance and proceed, please.
Your honors, may it please the court and also my esteemed opposing counsel. Thank you, everybody. I would like to start off by addressing some of the procedural questions that the court had raised in its order requiring supplemental briefing, because I think they're important and help us contextualize the rest of the arguments. The court had asked, and I think it's important to address, first of all, what exactly did the district court do? It said in its order, and this is because the parties did understand this was what the court wanted to do, that it was going to convert the motion to dismiss to a motion for summary judgment. That's in the first paragraph of the district court's memorandum opinion and order. And then we have a 200-page analysis of the various legal issues that were raised here. Now, we don't explicitly discuss summary judgment and the standards related to whether there's a genuine issue of material fact, but what we have presented to this court is really an evidentiary focus. We're not focused on the pleadings. We weren't focused on asking the court to grant our pleadings as true and then rule accordingly, but rather this all flows from somewhat the fast moving pace of and the manner in which the district court flowed, because what really happened was, instead of just doing a bunch of motion practice in the district court and hearings on motions, we ended up in a 2-day evidentiary hearing, essentially something that looked like a bench trial. And there were all kinds of...
Counsel, let me ask you this, because it's important for me to be able to follow you. In regards to the conversion to a motion for summary judgment, according to the docket sheet, you agreed to that. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay, I want to be sure I'm following where you are. Now you're saying, are you saying that you could not have a, excuse me, there's a picture that there, I lost my train of thought, excuse me. Are you saying that you agree that the district court could have a factual evidentiary hearing at that point?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe it was appropriate for the court to go ahead and hold the factual evidentiary hearing. There was a certain amount of efficiency with doing it that way, because there was this request for injunctive relief. And so the court chose to bring in parties and bring in witnesses. So
that counsel gets me to the point of where I wanted to go, because in your brief, instead of addressing a motion for summary judgment, it looks to me like that you're only arguing the first issue of the injunctive relief, and that is that the trial court erred, and not saying that you were more likely to succeed. Am I wrong there?
Well, Judge,
that's what I read in your brief.
Well, Judge, that's a fair characterization, and the reason we're in that situation is because the district court didn't characterize its order as our likelihood to succeed or not. What we were trying to do was interpret what the district court really did. It says in its first paragraph, I'm doing a summary judgment analysis, but then it doesn't talk about likelihood of success on the merits. It doesn't do findings of facts, which you would expect in an injunctive order. But what it does do is do a whole bunch of analysis of the different issues that were raised, and it relies on facts without doing fact finding at some point. For example, when it's talking about the IEP of the student JW, the court reads and relies on and interprets and offers its view of the IEP, but then it doesn't say, and this makes the petitioners more or less likely to succeed. What the judge instead finds, and he, and it sounds like he it's as if there was fact finding that we never saw, because he relies on essentially found facts to say the IEP requires this, but not this. And therefore the plaintiff or the petitioner loses. So
what are you asking us to do now?
So we would like the court to review the evidence that we put in, because even if we're talking about summary judgment or whether the court did a injunctive relief denial, either way, we're in a position where we put on a whole body of evidence through witnesses and exhibits. And if we were doing summary judgment, we were supposed to be looking at our evidence and viewing it in the light most favorable to us. And that's not discussed by the district court at all. But if that's what if that's what the district court did, then we would have the benefit of the evidence being viewed that way. And then this notion of, you know, viewing it, are we likely to proceed on the merits, instead of the district court having found facts seemingly against us. Either way, we have provided evidence to this court through the record below that shows that we should not have either been dismissed on summary judgment or on the pleadings, or that our injunction should have been denied. So we would be asking for a reversal, and the substantive reasons for our reversal, I can get into those, but I knew that the court had questions about this, and I wanted to, Your Honor, try to address that. So that's what I would say about that. I would like to move forward.
Hit pause button for a second here. I mean, legal constructs matter. I mean, it is evident in what you just were talking about that if the district court should have construed facts in light most favorable to you as non-movement, then there should have been a fulsome argument by you on appeal to that effect, such that we didn't have to make that argument for you. I mean, right now we're in a posture where if the operative issue is the court's denial, well, the court's granting of the converted motion for summary judgment, then we have to say, well, what are the facts that are operative in that determination? And what would the facts look like construed in light of most favorable to the non-movement without your guidance on how we do that? And in terms of what that universe of facts looks like. And because summary judgment is not talked about in your opening brief. And so legal constructs matter. Why doesn't that create a problem if what you're saying is you want us to rule on the court's motion for summary judgment decision? It's because the conversion is clear. The court may say, I think my recollection is at the end of the order, it says motion to dismiss, but that's how it was initially captioned. But the point is the court ruled on a motion for summary judgment. And so if we're supposed to review that, shouldn't we have some tools from the appellant to do that with?
Well, Your Honor, that's a fair point. And I believe that we have provided those tools to the court, because we're arguing within the construct that the district court gave us, because it isn't clear what the district court really did. And so what we did to be able to cover that was we showed Your Honors in the record where we put the facts on that would have prevented granting of summary judgment or denial of our preliminary injunction, because that's what really matters. The legal construct, it does affect how this court views it, but we covered that by emphasizing what you're supposed to emphasize either in a summary judgment or an injunctive relief situation, which it seemed like the court was doing both, which is we focused on our evidence and our facts, which were copiously presented, Judge. So okay. This court has the tools to address what we're trying to do.
Well, if I understand you correctly, you're saying here's the evidence we presented, so reverse. And the point would be that we have to then be in a position of applying that law to the evidence that you presented. And that's just not the way this works. Let me just pull back for a second and ask this question. It is clear that the court ruled on the preliminary injunction. It is clear the court granted summary judgment. And in your brief, if is it the grant of summary judgment determinative? In other words, even if you didn't challenge that, let's say we were to conclude that you did not successfully challenge that, irrespective of what the court did on the preliminary injunction, don't you lose?
Well, Judge, the issue is that what we're challenging has largely to do with the legal conclusions of the court. To the extent that that the court was doing either summary judgment or injunction analysis, well, with injunction analysis, with summary judgment analysis, I guess you could say that because the presumptions are supposed to be in our favor, and so when we present evidence, everybody's supposed to be viewing it in our favor. If the court can't find that, even with all the inferences drawn in our favor, that we should win, then of course implicitly we wouldn't be able to win on the injunction. So Judge, that's why we, you know, seeing what the district court did in its opinion, we chose to focus on presenting this court with the evidentiary record, and then the legal construct, we're working with it the best we can based on the fact that at one part of the decision, it says motion to dismiss granted. In the front of the decision for one paragraph, it says I'm converting this to a motion for summary judgment. And then through the entire analysis, it essentially does something like fact finding. So we have to give this court our legal arguments, and we have contended that the court was wrong on the law. And then beyond that, showing where we put the evidence in to survive a summary judgment motion. And so if the court's reversal is to say the court shouldn't have granted summary judgment because look at all this evidence that should be construed in favor of the petitioners.
Yes, which is, then that's fine. Which is an argument we would have to make on our own, because you did not make that argument. And so we would have to make that argument on our own. We'd have to look at your facts. We'd have to construe them in the light most favorable to the non-movement. And then we'd have to apply the law that you've given us to make that determination. That's not, at least my understanding, what my role is, what our role is. The question I was really want to make sure I understand your response to is this. Let's assume, this is all hypothetical because I'm playing this out and want to hear your view. Let's assume that our conclusion is that basically you've waived any argument on the motion for summary judgment. That means that the district court's ruling on that stands. Does that end it? In other words, no matter what you say about the motion for the denial of the preliminary injunction, you're still going to lose.
No, Your Honor, I don't believe that's true because there has been copious presentation of the relevant legal arguments and the factual record. So it would not be appropriate for the court to rule that way.
I thought, and this is why I want to know it particularly, and if you can point me to some authority that says this, I'm welcome to hear it. But it was my understanding that the summary judgment determination essentially resolves the dispute. In other words, that as long as they're both dealing with the same merits issues, which essentially they are, that if the court says we grant the summary judgment, and let's assume that ends up being an unchallenged decision, no matter whether the court erred on the grant denial of the preliminary injunction or not, that really at this would not matter because it is said that the state is entitled to relief. What am I missing on that?
I think, Judge, that you're arguing that there is a waiver here because of an inadequate reference to summary judgment. And we did cite this court to some authority in our supplemental brief about, you know, what constitutes adequate. And when it comes to summary judgment or, you know, what you're dealing with here, because the substance of what the arguments are, both legally and factually, are presented, it's not fair to say that anything is waived just because there's not an explicit discussion of whether this was summary judgment or fact-finding by the court, especially when you review the district court's decision and you find that it contains fact-finding. So Judge, I think a waiver argument is unfair at this point. I have 30 seconds left, so I would like to just try to address anything else.
Mr. Ray, I'm going to spot you at least 5 minutes. Go ahead, please. Just
continue. Okay. And I'm here to answer your questions. I thank you. So I would like to kind of move on then to the mootness argument very briefly, which was raised because at the time of the briefing being completed in this case, we thought we were out of the woods, and everybody was talking about the vaccine, and everybody was talking about how everything's opening up and the schools were opening up. Well, suddenly we're across the country, we're moving back into a restrictive situation. So to say that this situation is not capable of repetition, but evading review, I think becomes more remote and more speculative.
Well, counsel, on that issue, have you pointed to any evidence that the state will reimpose remote learning?
No, Your Honor, but I would say this, the state today is going to be arguing that it was right to impose remote learning given the cases and given
that isn't the question. The state went back to in-person learning last March. And you have the burden to show that there's an exception to mootness. You haven't even argued one of the exceptions, which is voluntary cessation, either in your brief or your supplemental brief. And you haven't marshaled a single fact to this court to show that there is any reasonable possibility that the state's going to go back to remote learning. So where does that leave you on mootness?
Judge, I agree. We haven't supplemented the record or offered new information. But I would say that what we all see is that we're all moving back into restrictive situations, which led to the original closures.
Are we just going off what we see in the newspaper now in making jurisdictional determinations?
Your Honor, that's a fair point. I was going to point out about mootness, Judge, that the complaint also requested declaratory relief, and it also raised IDEA claims. Which includes compensatory education. So whenever there's IDEA violations, compensatory education is still on the table as a remedy that is available, and that is prospective, and therefore it's not moot. So there's many reasons why we're not in a moot. Why mootness is not an appropriate analysis here either, and this is a live controversy.
Has the declaration of emergency been rescinded?
I have not heard of a rescission of the declaration of emergency, but I it is fair, as Judge Matheson has said, that we haven't heard indication that school closure is imminent at this time. So I can say that, you know, in fairness. I believe I have 2.5 minutes left, and I don't exactly know how much time do I have left.
I gave you an additional 5 minutes now, and we'll see how the rebuttal goes. But this was your 5 minutes to continue in your initial argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Time. So go ahead, please, and take the rest of the time if you want it.
So moving to this, the final points, Judge, when it comes to the IDEA claim, is very simple. There was a student who had an IEP, and several witnesses put in evidence. And of course, we also put in some exhibits during the briefing stage regarding the educational impact of the state's coronavirus response as far as remote learning. We had parents, teacher, administrators, and counselors who testified that the student with an IEP, her IEP required her to be in the general educational setting, and that when the school decided to interpret that to mean she's remote while everybody else is remote, the testimony was that she was effectively denied an education because she couldn't function under this new kind of unilateral change in the way the state was treating her IEP. So it was pretty basic, Judge. And then with respect to the non-IEP children, we've argued, judges, that there was not a rational basis for the state's actions here. Judge Browning at the hearing he said on the record, and we cited this to the court in our brief of where this is, that he didn't see any science presented by the state here. And so they've insisted that this is all science. They followed the science. Judge Browning said, I saw no science here. And we agree with Judge Browning on that, but we believe that from that conclusion should have flowed the or from that statement should have flowed the conclusion that there wasn't a rational basis for what happened here, Your Honors. And so I would leave you with that. That's my time.
Thank you, Mr. Wright. We'll hear from the state, please.
Good afternoon. May it please the court, Your Honors, counsel. My name is Holly Agajanian. I'm the attorney for Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham and former Cabinet Secretary Ryan Stewart. Your Honors, the discussion about the summary judgment standard is important, and it's important for several reasons. So first, I would note that in Judge Browning's opinion, he says, it's on page 6, that he can't do the quote-unquote traditional fact-finding of a motion for summary judgment, which, as you read the opinion, becomes clear. What it means is he can't do findings of fact number 1 through 175, the way it's typically done in a summary judgment motion. Instead, what the judge does do is he spends 18 pages going through facts from external documents submitted by the plaintiffs, facts from external documents submitted by the defendants, and facts that were elicited at the hearing on this matter. And on starting on page 64 of Judge Browning's opinion and going on for about 3 or 4 pages is actually a very substantive discussion of the laws around summary judgment and when it's appropriate. And before that, he actually goes through the analysis under the 12B1 and 12B6 standard. And that's important because under the 12B1 standard, to convert something to summary judgment, the judge notes that because there is a jurisdictional question at issue, that there is fact-finding that's necessary. And the jurisdictional question goes very specifically to the IDEA claims and to the claims of JW about whether her individualized educational program is sufficient for her and whether she's exhausted her administrative remedies. That's a jurisdictional question.
And it's a different,
and that's why that standard matters.
And I don't want to get too far afield, but on that particular point, didn't the district court find that her claim is now moot?
That's correct, Your Honor. So at the beginning, her IEP had a technical error in it. And the judge actually initially said, send it back, said, go fix that. And once that was done, then she needs to go through the administrative process. That's what it's for. And what's important about that, and what I'm going to stress too, and I'm not being glib, but the IEP has the I in it for a reason. The I is individual. And that's why we can't paint with this broad brush that the plaintiffs are asking you to apply. Because for students in this program, there is nobody better to assess what they need than their team. And the team consists of the parents and the educators. And what that specific child needs individually cannot be decided. It not only is it inefficient to go straight to a federal judge on it, but that judge is not in the best position to make those determinations. That's what that team is for. And that's what the IDEA contemplates, to give a very specific, appropriate public education to students with special needs. And that's why in this case, when the plaintiffs argue that all disabled students need X, Y, and Z, that flies in the face of the IDEA. And that flies in the face of an IEP, because every kid is different. And so that's why, you know, really, frankly, if we're honest, it's sort of a backdoor argument about getting all the kids back in schools to say that the kids who don't have an IEP, that there's a socialization requirements for the students that do have them, and that they need to be having in-person learning in the general education classroom. In this case, not only does the IDEA not govern students who don't have an IEP in general, they're just not subject to that statute. But again, remembering that the least restrictive environment is what is appropriate. And in this case, for a year and change, the least restrictive environment was a Zoom classroom. And everybody acknowledges that's not as effective as in-person learning. But the LRE for this period of time was the Zoom classroom. And if that wasn't working for JW, which it wasn't, then they amended her IEP and they got her in-person learning 4 days a week. If there were additional problems with that, that needs to go through the administrative process. That's what Judge Browning found. And that's a correct finding because, again, that team is the team that's most effective to determine the child's needs.
If I may, let me ask you something about the capable repetition argument in the mootness context. I asked Mr. Ray whether the governor had or whether through some process the emergency declaration had been rescinded. And it's my understanding that it is not. Well, if it is not, why is this case not different than the number of cases that have been cited that have found the matter to be moot where the declaration had expired by its own terms? In other words, one would have to reinitiate one in order to take these actions that were complained about. Here, the governor could act on a dime, couldn't she, if she thought it was necessary to do so? And so why isn't that a distinction with a difference?
I'll tell you why, Judge Holmes, because the standard isn't just capable of being repeated. It's whether it's reasonably likely to. And I think that's a very, very important distinction because in this case, we've seen the schools are still open, as we noted in our briefs, even with the Delta variant, the schools are still open. And what we don't have now, it's not even exactly, even though obviously we're talking about schools and we're talking about COVID, the game has changed. We have vaccines now, right? The teachers, we actually put the teachers right at the head of the line to get vaccinated. So we have vaccines. We know much more about this disease than we did, in 2019 and 2020. We have robust testing schedules. And so the situation isn't the same as it was. And is it the question really, like I said, is it reasonably likely to reoccur? And we have not. It's not like in the Roman Catholic case where they changed the goalposts 8 times in a month. This is one. We made our decision that April to reopen schools, and they have been open since then. Can I say never? No, I can't say that because we don't know what's going to happen. But is it reasonably likely?
You can't say never in the expiration situation either. And of course, that has been deemed to allow for mootness. But here in this situation, if the governor is watching the numbers, and if there's something we learned from the Delta variant is we don't know. You know, we thought the world was open, happy days are here again, and we're not happy. I mean, so what? I guess what I'm trying to understand, you're right that we have to look at the reasonable likelihood. But when you're talking about at least the alleged infringement of rights, how likely do you have to be? I mean, if this governor has the power to do what her job, and if she sees the numbers going up and she can just on a dime turn and say, we're closing, shutting things down, why shouldn't that create the potential for the infringement that they allege?
You know, I think that we're probably just saying the same thing with albeit a little bit different languages. Is there the potential always? Is it reasonably likely? No.
Okay. All right. I understand your position on that. Go ahead.
Okay. Thank you. The other thing that I would note about the opinion in this case is that on page 64, Judge Browning cites the Plustwick case. And not only does he cite it, he actually underlines for emphasis the idea that when there's a summary judgment motion, the non-moving party, in this case, the plaintiffs, if we show that they lack evidence of an element of their claim, since a complete failure of proof concerning an essential element of the non-moving party's case necessarily renders all other facts immaterial. And then the judge goes on much later in his opinion on page 123, to note that even though the plaintiffs insist that the lack of in-person instruction in and of itself is a deprivation of a basic education, the judge finds that the record doesn't show any indication that a temporary prohibition of in-person learning deprives the plaintiffs of a basic education. Mr. Ray spoke about the facts that were at issue. We did have a very extensive hearing, and Mr. Ray spoke about the fact that they have provided that they have provided evidence. And I would note for the court again, they did provide evidence. They provided theirs. They provided essentially half of an appendix, which is also not in keeping with the rules. And in this case, the defendants had to actually submit a supplemental appendix with the rest of the evidence that was before the court. Judge Browning did make the comment about science. I submit that that's being taken out of context. And I don't know that there's much more that we need to say about that, given, again, that the evidence from the appendix is in front of the court. And there was loads and loads of science presented. I would also note, to the extent that Mr. Ray is discussing compensatory education, that was not raised in the briefing, and it was not a requested form of relief in the complaint.
Oh, really? So that's not in the complaint, because that caught me by surprise. They don't ask for that in the complaint, and it's not in the briefing.
I feel free to correct me, Mr. Ray, but course. I don't think it is.
Okay. All right.
And so, Your Honors, at the end of the day, what we have is a rational basis for the decision to close the schools for in-person learning for non-disabled students. Because again, let's remember, students with disabilities who needed it were able to obtain services at the school, just like JW was in this case. The constitutional claims are subject to rational basis review. And as the court found, and as we've discussed, that threshold is easily met in this case. The procedural due process claims have to fail because, again, the governor's action and the secretary's action were quasi-legislative in nature. And that is the procedural due process that's required for those types of limitations that we have in this case. With regard to the IEDA claims, again, JW's claim is moot. There is an administrative procedure, and that's there for a remedy. I know that the appellants in this case have tried to use kind of shoehorn in a 1983 standard for that. This circuit has expressly rejected that because there is a very, very robust framework under the IDEA for children to challenge and amend their individual educational programs.
Is that 1983 ground, is that sufficient in itself to reject or to affirm the district court on the IDEA claim?
Yeah, yes, it is. I mean, because again, in this case, as the judge has noted, what there was actually a failure of proof on the plaintiff's part. So I would submit that is enough.
But I mean, it's categorically, the fact that they tried to pursue an IDEA claim within the construct of 1983 at the threshold is just a non-starter. Would that be enough?
Yes. No, I'm sorry. I think I misunderstood what you were saying before. Yes. It's a failure to plead adequately under the appropriate statute with the appropriate remedial scheme.
All right.
And I think finally, you know, Your Honor, one of the things, again, that I just want to point out is that the IDEA is a statute with a very, very specific intent. And its intent is to help children primarily with disabilities in their educational process. There are all kinds of disabilities. There are intellectual disabilities. You know, there are sort of emotional, developmental disabilities. There are physical disabilities. And throughout the plaintiff's case, what they have essentially done is painted all of these kids with one broad brush, saying they all need the same thing. And that's simply inappropriate. Because again, that takes the I out of the IEP. And there are certainly, I think I said something that just triggered my Alexa, so I apologize if you heard that. So there are certainly cases where there might be plenty of other kids who actually thrived during in-person learning. There might be plenty of kids who have lung or sort of breathing problems, and that's part of their disability, and might not be great to push them back into the classroom so quickly as plaintiffs would have you do. So for those reasons, Your Honor, from top to bottom, from mootness to the IDEA, to the very fact that the appropriate standards were not discussed, and that they should have been, because again, this takes you to a jurisdictional question at the outset. For all of those reasons, Your Honor, we ask that Judge Browning's opinion be affirmed.
Counsel, I've been waiting. I wanted to hear both arguments. Can you hear me all right?
Yes, Judge Baldock.
I want to go back to the governor's end of the remote learning process that was going on and ask that, is it ended because it was self-correcting of a wrongful action, or that it was just fine, that the governor was just finding the action was no longer necessary? Which,
well, I mean, without getting too into executive privilege issues, Your Honor, what I would say is that by the time the vaccines were starting to roll out, by the time we were learning more and more and more about this disease, the state actually at the same time or right around this time also had capacity restrictions in businesses. And the same thing, it was also based on, we had a tiered system at that point, from blue down to red in terms of capacity restrictions, sort of similar to what we did with the gating criteria for the schools.
So are you saying it's just no longer necessary?
Yes.
Okay. Well, if it's no longer necessary, then why doesn't voluntary cessation exception apply?
Well, the voluntary cessation applies in terms of why it's moved. But again, but the pivot that I would note is that I think what the appellants would say is that it's voluntary cessation to do an end run around this court's jurisdiction, which is not the case.
Thank you.
Anything else from my colleagues? All right, Mr. Ray, you don't need to take it all, but we'll give you 2 minutes to wrap up. You're on mute.
Thank you, Your Honors and Counsel. Just very briefly, when it comes to this idea that we're trying to paint with a broad brush every single kid, again, I would go back to when it comes to student JW and her IEP, the evidence was about her and her IEP and what it required. And members, it is true, as counsel pointed out, when you do an IEP, there's a team there that puts it together. And that team includes a number of people, including the students' teachers, the students' parents, counselors. And many members of that IEP team testified at the hearing that this student wasn't receiving the education that her IEP contemplated. And that was because of unilateral action by the governor. It was the governor who painted with a broad brush, sent everybody home from school and did remote learning. And we also would point out that this student, when Judge Browning made this this change to the ordered this change to the IEP, the student didn't get in-person learning. She was in an empty classroom in front of a computer still, so it was still really remote learning, and it didn't meet the IEP.
There's an exhaustion process that you can use if that were in fact the case, right?
And that would be available if this hadn't flowed from a governor's order, Judge, imposed on the school. I'll stand for questions, or else that's my time, Your Honors.
All right, thank you, Counsel.
Thank you.
Seeing no questions, case is submitted.